is the Victorian Country Hour with Warwick Long on ABC Radio Victoria.
Back in the studio and back to discussing what has really risen up a lot this week. Information around the latest dingo fence or wild dog fence being built in regional Victoria. We heard about it at the VFF conference from the Agriculture Minister. We've been slowly getting a little bit more information along the lines about how long it is, how it's going to work. Today, we'll go to the source, the farmers where the fence is going to be built. We'll talk to you and they'll tell you why they're taking the money from the government, because they think it's all they're going to get.
The situation we've been in, we're happy to get anything we can get, because pretty much we've felt very abandoned since this whole thing started. We were told we'd get an authority to control protected wildlife, which we haven't been able to get. There's still conjecture over about the number of dogs. It's just been an absolute disgrace up there, and this is about the only tangible thing we've got so far. So we're prepared to grab onto it with both hands and take it.
But what does that mean for the neighbours where the fence isn't going to go? One of them will join you to talk about their experience too. Plus, we've got a big wool merger, a possible dairy one, and some pretty cool kids from just over the border that have quite the substantial agricultural operation. All of that and more coming up for you today on the Country Hour.
The Victorian Country Hour with Warwick Long on ABC Radio Victoria.
And if you missed it, we're back in the studio today because we spent yesterday at the Wool Selling Centre in Melbourne. Yep. In Tottenham, just out the back of West Footscray, I could see the skyscrapers of Melbourne, but millions of dollars of wool was being traded and sold. And a huge part of the theme of that day was, were we going to pass the 2,000 cent mark on the Eastern Market Indicator, which is that price guide for the wool industry. Wool hasn't been 20 bucks a kilo for some time, and we were keeping an eye on whether the market was going to pass that. It was a strong market. The prices were going up, but I can tell you that the wool market, well, ended up closing at 1,979 cents. We didn't quite get to the 2,000 cent mark. I told you we'd update you today. That's where we are. We're 21 cents shy of that magical barrier, but wool prices are at their highest points since October 2018. So there is good news. Let's talk something sheep industry adjacent right now, though, and go to the northwest of the state. A livestock producer on the southern border of the Big Desert says a government-supported fence to keep wild dogs or dingoes off his property will push the problem onto his neighbours, but he's happy to take the money. The state government is subsidising 70 kilometres of exclusion fences for a cluster of five farms, which are deemed the worst affected by predation since legal control of dingoes was banned 27 months ago. We first heard from the Agriculture Minister at the VFF conference saying that the government was funding these exclusion fences. We've heard more details on these fences from Agriculture Victoria and DECA this week, saying, yes, that program was initiated in March. So Angus Verley spoke to Alan Bennett, who farms north of Yanak, who says it's a small win, but it will only make the problem worse for others.
85% of sheep deaths reported in the Big Desert have been sustained by the five of us since the lifting of the unprotection order on the 14th of March 2024. And after a lot of to-ing and fro-ing and talking, and basically we've had no support whatsoever apart from a few cameras set up, and at the end we've come to this point where they're prepared to support us with some boundary exclusion fencing to try and secure just our little local area.
And talk me through the nature of the program and the nature of the fence. So what portion of the fence will the government cover in terms of the cost? And will it totally ring those five properties, or will it be more of a patchwork with gaps in it?
Well, the biggest issue we've got is the roads. They've got some technology from Western Australia and stuff they reckon they can use to make those roads dog-proof. They're probably going to try and install some gates across the smaller roads. It's a barrier fence around all the five of us, sort of almost, well, we virtually touch. So the fence can take a continuous path around on our edges with the government land. Yeah, that's where we're at the moment.
And the government says 70 kilometres of fence, is that right?
Well, that's what I've been led to believe. We've already done a lot of fencing, and about 20 kilometres of our fence will form part of this barrier. So we've already done that, and then that'll tie in with the neighbouring fences and these road crossings. to give that whole area a, like a barrier fence.
So, Alan, do you know when the government quotes 70 kilometres of exclusion fence, is that 70 kilometres that they're supporting, or is that including the sections of private fence like your own?
No, that's 70 kilometres of what they're supporting. So they will support some of the stuff I've already done.
And the government has also told us it's paid about $270,000 so far. But if we're talking 70 kilometres of fencing at many thousands of dollars per kilometre, what percentage of the cost per kilometre do you think the government will end up paying?
Look, I would think what the government's proposing will pay about 50% of the total cost. And when you think about it, well, if they're our neighbours and they're paying 50%, that's okay, and we're doing, you know, the majority of the work on it. But, Angus, the situation we've been in, we're happy to get anything we can get because pretty much we've felt very abandoned since this whole thing started. We were told we'd get an authority to control protected wildlife, which we haven't been able to get. There's still conjecture over about the number of dogs. There's still conjecture over whether Adelaide Uni's come out now and said they're 30%. 30% domestic dogs, our dogs. So, you know, I'm going to call them wild dogs. But it's just been an absolute disgrace up there. And this is about the only tangible thing we've got so far. So we're prepared to grab onto it with both hands and take it because it's about as much as we're going to get at the moment.
And, Alan, I understand that the month just gone has been the worst period for you in terms of attacks since March 2024.
Yeah. But it comes and goes. The dogs move around. The issue we've got now is that they breed in the area, so we've got a group of young dogs, family group that are staying together and causing a lot of mayhem. They're sort of breaking all the old traditional rules about what dogs did when they entered the open country because they were single dogs that would be getting removed. Now they're a family unit that are living and very aware of what's in the environment and where to go and water and stock and stuff. So they're moving around, but like we had a hole under existing exclusion fence that the dogs were using to get to a clay hole and to get water. My daughter set a camera up there, and in 24 hours she got a picture of five different dogs at that hole. So this is the problem we've got. Like they're saying, oh, they're endangered, there's no dogs. Well, all I know in our little neck of the woods, there's a lot of them, and they're active, and they're changing their pattern. They're not just grabbing a sheep to eat a little bit. They're going around and crunching lambs and stuff, not eating them, just... We lost 20 ewes and 30 lambs in one attack in one night.
What do you do if you find animals inside the exclusion fence on your property?
I've raised this issue with AgVic, and I've said we're going to have a problem here once this fence is completed. We're going to have a program to get rid of the dogs from inside of the fence. They're telling me that's going to be a trap and release. But the problem we've got is what these dogs now are absolutely entrenched in our local area, and that's become their range and their habitat. And it's not like we've got a dog popping out from the desert and we can send him back there. These dogs associate this area with their natural range now.
And if they can't get access to your property and your neighbour's property, does that mean that they'll just follow the fence until it comes to an end and then move on to other properties?
Yep. Yep, and that's the problem with any fencing, and that's the problem with all the fencing we've done. There's an end to the fence. So unless the whole big desert is encircled in a fence, we're going to have this same problem all the time. I've raised this with them, and they've got some of this technology from Western Australia, which they actually just installed now, which is an audible alarm, a motion-activated audible alarm, and they've installed a couple of them in a couple of spots to trial them and see how they go, and they reckon they might be an option at the end of the fence. But I'm absolutely with you. Any fence has got an end to it, and all the fencing we've done so far on our properties, all it's done is basically make the dogs travel in different areas or go on different roads or go to the end of the fence to get around it.
So for your neighbours and the way they feel, Alan, obviously it's not your fault, but are they going to be angry now if the problem comes to them?
Absolutely. Absolutely they will be. And some of my neighbours have suffered because of the fencing I've done. Because it's pushed the dogs to go into my neighbour's place and not mine. But at the moment, Angus, what else can we do? We've got no other alternative. We've got lethal control is completely off the table. I'm running donkeys now as well. The whole guardian animal thing's just fluff around the edges. It's never going to solve the problem. Like, fencing is the only thing we can do. It's not a perfect solution. They will not allow us to go back to lethal control. We don't know what we're protecting, whether they're... Well, I continue to call them wild dogs. I refuse to call them dingoes, wild dogs. Like, that's the problem. It is not a perfect situation. These dogs have come accustomed area. They will continue to kill sheep. And a lot of the time now, they're killing sheep just for fun, which everyone said they never, ever did. But now they do it. It's just, have a bad attack. It is absolute chaos.
That's Alan Bennett on the southern edge of the Big Desert, one of the five farmers that is getting money from the government to fence off areas of that Big Desert that interact with his farm, because those farms were the largest farms getting predation from dingoes or wild dogs on their sheep flock. Let's hear from one of Alan's neighbours. Don Murdoch is a direct neighbour who finds himself in precisely the situation Alan Bennett was talking about. He says he's going to be forced to fund his own fence of about 12 kilometres just to make sure the problem from Alan doesn't get pushed onto where he is.
We are the neighbour to that group of five that have got the subsidy to fence their property, and they haven't done it yet, but they're about to, and as a result, we have to do it. Otherwise, we've just become the next gateway in for the dogs.
Okay, so eventually, if you're standing on your block, you'll be able to see the fence, but it won't be on your property.
That's right. No, it joins us on the southeast corner. So, yeah, we'll be able to almost smell it from our place, yep.
And Alan Bennett talked about while he was happy to get some government funding for that fence, he acknowledged that it would push the dingoes or wild dogs onto neighbouring properties. Do you think that's exactly what will happen at your place?
100% guarantee. Yeah, there's no doubt. And our neighbour again to the west has come up to the same conclusion, and he's in the process of putting his fence up. But yeah, the longer we dally, the more damage we're going to cop from dogs coming through our place.
So for you, then, is it a matter of 100% privately funding exclusion fencing?
That's it. Yes, and no budgeting for it. It's just turned up. You know, we can't say, oh, next year we're going to put aside. Well, our fence will be something like $250,000, and we've just got to find out straight away or suffer the consequences.
Have you had attacks on your livestock to this point?
Oh, yes. Yeah. We've probably been a bit slack about reporting them, but we've just marked our lambs up there, and as you're probably aware, it's been a wonderful season. Now, the sheep were in the best order they've ever been for lambing, and the results have been very, very disappointing. You know, I would say we've probably lost 30%. Of our lambs.
And Don, if we go back to pre-March 2024, when there was the dog control program in place, did you have an issue then?
Oh, very small compared to now. Yeah, it wasn't a major issue, but certainly in the last 2 years, we're hurting.
So Don, you sound like you're frustrated, but you're sort of resigned to your fate as well.
I'm definitely frustrated and, resigned to my fate in that I'm hoping that the exclusion fence will, I'd like to think it'll eliminate the problem, but listening to Alan this morning, it's probably not going to eliminate it, but it would greatly reduce it. And, I was aware when he was talking this morning of properties further in from the boundary of the park that are having dog attacks in our area now too, so it would suggest that the dogs have established themselves in the farmland as well. I'd just like to see a coordinated effort to do something about it instead of just, going up there and finding dead sheep. Talk about mental health and profitability and all those sort of things that farmers are dealing with. Well, this is a kick in the wrong direction by 100%.
And obviously, just to state the facts, the government is cash-strapped. Do you think there's any prospect they would stump up the many millions of dollars that it would cost to entirely fence the desert?
Unlikely, isn't it? I mean, where the desert is, it's as remote as you can get. As far as someone living in Melbourne, they're probably not even aware that it exists. The fire tracks and the average road access to that sort of place doesn't make it a mainstream drive for any politician. So, I think it's unlikely, and well, Alan's been a great spokesman for the problem, and that's the only way of sort of getting any action, I hope. But we're a small number, and they'd rather build a fancy road in Melbourne than put a fence up in Tilopia Downs, I fear.
That's Don Murdoch, whose property borders the dingo exclusion fence being built along Fire Farm south of the Big Desert. 1300 977 222. If you want to have your say, you can text to 0467 842 722. Another neighbour, I think, is on the line too. Andrew. Andrew, are you near this wild dog fence that's going to be built too?
Yes, Warwick. If we look to the horizon to the north of our farm, we can see where the dog fence may or may not end up. The problem is that not every sheep producer in that 70 kilometres is going to take the offer up. They don't all think the same way with the 50% subsidy, and they may decide, look, I'll just go cropping, and this will put gaps in it and make the whole thing a complete and utter waste of time, money and effort.
Does it at least give protection to those who do have the fence, do you think, at all, Andrew? Or with what you're saying there with the holes, is that going to mean dogs are going to get out and eventually roam back towards these farms?
They'll be funneled out into neighbouring properties. There's already the case where sheep are now being withdrawn from farming land, and then the neighbour further to the south gets attacked. So we are the third option back for the dingoes, or, as the Adelaide University would say, wild dogs.
To be fair to that Adelaide University study, I think they found it was 13%. Not dingo genetics, so it still says a majority of these animals are dingoes, yeah?
Yes, they're saying, but the message that's being portrayed is that they're as pure as a Fraser Island dingo. When you see these animals, they've got a bushy tail, they look like a cross between sort of a Kelpie, a collie and a German Shepherd. There's just, yes, they are unique, but uniquely bad is never going to be a good thing, is it?
So what do you see as a path forward here? Because the government has clearly declared that these animals need to be protected. There's been work done to protect those animals. There was a big spike in predation of sheep, and that's led to a decision which wasn't initially going to happen, because we asked a lot of questions about an exclusion fence at the beginning of this announcement. That wasn't part of the government's pet plan. Quietly, $270,000 now and more will be spent on putting up this 70-kilometre dingo fence along the Big Desert National Park. So, Andrew, for landholders like you, do you want more money handed out to extend that fence to protect people like you? Is that the best outcome you can see happening, or is there something I'm missing here?
The best outcome would be to return it to where it was. The initial estimates of the amount of dogs in the Big Desert was set by the very few that were actually coming out onto open grazing land and killing sheep. There were very few. I think there was well under a dozen, four or five perhaps maximum a year, two or three most years. So from that they deduced that there weren't actually many dogs out there. That was the wrong way of looking at it. That they put some trail cameras out there, very, very few, in an area twice as big as the ACT. Honestly, the whole thing is just a complete joke.
But if it just spent... Andrew, I can get your point, and I can hear the anger, and I think we've heard that from the previous two people on the show too already. But I suppose if the government's not going to do that, they've stated their position clearly, what is the best outcome that you can see actually happening? Would it be to fund fences for you or
no,
something else?
A permit to control.
A permit that's to control, that's what you want.
That is the only way to do it. I think it's proved that nobody actually has a handle on the amount of wild dogs out there, significantly more than what they thought. I think it's also proved that stupidity like Maremna dogs and donkeys are a complete and utter waste of time as well. Just go back to that to what we originally had, and then the status quo will go back again. And let's face it, Warwick, we're talking five growers and $3 million, perhaps as much as $4 million, just in this little area, a complete ring around the big desert, you could be talking, in a few years' time, tens of millions of dollars.
Andrew, I'm really grateful for your time and insight. Thank you very much for calling in and talking through a lot of that with me. 1300 977 222 is the number you can call too if you'd like to. We'll keep moving right now because I want to talk about a wool merger because we spent a bit of time in the wool sheds yesterday watching a lot get auctioned. And a sign, I suppose, of the industry has getting smaller in terms of the amount of bales being produced each year is a number of mergers and changes in that industry that's happening right now. And a 35-year-old wool broking business and the largest wool exporter in Australia are going to merge their businesses from July the 1st. Quality Wool and Tech Wool Trading sell from clients in South Australia, Victoria and New South Wales. With the lowest national clip in 100 years, the industry is starting to see this trend of mergers and consolidation, despite the highest prices since 2018. New South Wales and Victoria Area Manager for Quality Wool, Jenny Turner, told Annie Brown a few more details about this merger.
Quality Wool has its headquarters in South Australia. Tech Wool is largely in the country division. Their business is largely around Victoria, South Australia and into southeast New South Wales. Two parts to the Tech Wool company. Firstly, there's the private division, which is we're delighted to have that come into our brand, which is going to make our catalogue hugely more efficient. But Tech Wool Trading on the export side is the biggest exporter in the country, with a huge client base, a very stable business and a very big supporter of the Australian wool industry.
So what brought about the merger? Like, why join the two companies together?
Yes, look, so the owners of the business have been very friendly competitors for a long time. We enjoy an excellent relationship. And look, really with the, we're all seeing the lots of talk about industry needing to consolidate. We have a diminishing wool clip. We've already seen traditional processes in Australia combining their forces. And this really is a future-proofing move for both of these businesses. It represents a huge economy of scale for both of us. And with rising costs to growers, we really need, as an industry, to be able to make ourselves leaner, efficient, sustainable, future-proof, and competitive.
So we're seeing a lot of consolidation in the wool industry. So the national clip is at its lowest in 100 years. We've also seen processing mills merge recently. We're seeing lots of different things happen. Do you think we'll see more merging like we're seeing with these two wool brokers, so Quality Wool and Tech Trading Wool? Do you think this is a trend that we're going to see more of in the coming years in the wool industry?
I think so, Annie. We probably don't have a choice. We no longer have the luxury of ample product going through our systems. Growers are faced with the terrible irony of the fact that we have an absolutely flourishing prices at the moment, both on the wool side and the meat side, but there really are financial constraints into coming back into the industry. Getting back into breeding is probably going to be a 2 to 3 to 4 step process, with side quests going into cattle and fodder production. We're seeing growers really diversify, moving into more intensive systems of fattening before they get back into breeding. And on the industry side of things, there is much talk about coming together. As I said, we just don't have the luxury of competing against each other. We're really in a time where we need to future-proof ourselves, but not to be negative about the shrinking wool clip. This really is an opportunity for more innovation to come out. It's an opportunity for creating systems which are really efficient into the future.
Yeah, because like you said there, so when we say industry consolidation, that sounds it sounds like the everything's shutting down and getting smaller. But like you said, on the flip side is that the pricing in the wool market at the moment is phenomenal. It's like edging towards $20 a kilo. Do you think it'll bring more producers back into wool?
Look, high prices do have a history of attracting people back into wool or any other commodity. Not that we like to talk about ourselves as a commodity. And the wool market at the moment, you know, it's like having a big party, but there's no one there at the moment. But look, I think, you know, there is a great love for wool and a great love for sheep historically, culturally. What I think is important to get across is that the industry really needs sustainable, often big structural movements to keep us moving forward. There are so many opportunities, but if we don't encourage growers with more competitive systems, then we are going to be in trouble.
That is Jenny Turner, New South Wales and Victoria Area Manager with Quality Wool, speaking there with our reporter Annie Brown about that merger between Quality Wool and Tech Wool Trading. You're listening to The Country Hour. Warwick Long with you, 28 minutes to one. Let's go to rural news. Jane McNaughton has that for you today. Hi, Jane.
Good afternoon, Woz. Innovative insect farming startup business GoTerra has entered voluntary administration. GoTerra is an Australian first-of-a-kind clean tech using black soldierfly larvae combined with modular robotics and biological systems to convert commercial and residential food waste into sustainable protein for livestock and high-grade fertiliser. Documents listed by the Australian Securities and Investments Commission show the company board on Wednesday appointed Tenio's Daniel Worley and Martin Ford to serve as administrators. GoTerra's founder, Olympia Jaeger, has said on the social media site LinkedIn that the business had contracts renewed and proven technology, but not enough money to scale. Global dairy business Saputo says it's had a fall in revenues despite making billions over the last year. In the 25-26 financial year, revenues for Saputo in Australia totaled $2.57 billion, down $136 million or 5% as compared to the $2.7 billion last fiscal year. In the 25-26 financial year, adjusted earnings before interest, taxes, depreciation and amortisation totaled $162 million, up $27 million or 20% as compared to the $135 million in the previous year. Saputo Chief Carl Kaliser commented on the Australian division during a media briefing from Canada.
Australia's performance this quarter reflects both improving market conditions and the strategic value of our footprint. As pricing strengthened across global dairy markets, we were positioned to capture the upside selectively, directing volumes to the markets and channels offering the best returns. Demand patterns remained uneven, and we were intentional in how we responded. Rather than pursuing volume for its own sake, we prioritize value creation, optimizing mix, aligning pricing, and actively managing where and how we deploy our production capacity. On profitability, improving market conditions provided a tailwind. But what is more important is how we executed within that environment. Despite constraints on milk availability in certain regions, we continue to optimize our portfolio in real time, ensuring we are consistently allocating milk to higher value opportunities.
The buffalo industry in Northern Australia is claiming a win on export protocols to Indonesia. The industry met in Jakarta a few weeks ago and has seemingly already led to a change in the types of animals that can be live exported. Ross Ainsworth, Executive Officer of the Northern Territory Buffalo Industry Council, explains.
The Indonesian government was very keen to increase the numbers of buffalo that they could import from Australia. Whilst we're not easily able to increase the total number that are mustered here from various sources, what I explained that we could do is if they modified their health protocol to allow young pregnant heifers to go, then that would increase the actual numbers they got from the same number we mustered at this end. And sure enough, they came good. And about a week or 10 days ago, we got the official announcement that a new protocol had been approved by both governments. Now, pregnant heifers can go, so they take them to feedlots and they get the calf, and then they either they have the option to either continue to breed from that animal or fatten both the mother and the calf and add them to the slaughter animals that are available for meat production.
And this week marked the end of an era for six generations of the Gladigo dairy farming family in South Australia. Former Australian Dairy Farmers President Nick Gladigo shut the gate on the family dairy at Breezy Heights, ending a generational link to dairy that stretched back to 1859. It's been a work in progress to step away from the dairy industry. Having crossed off his Mount Torrens farm earlier this year, Rick talked about the decision to leave.
After 30-odd years, I shut my own dairy and I went back up to the home farm, back to where it all began. And yesterday was the last of the cows there. Then on the truck off to a couple of other farms. So shut the gate, as I said, and that's it. You know, my son is interested in farming, but dairying really wasn't his calling. So that was sort of part of making the decision, and my brother's kids and my other kids here, my girls, they're sort of not interested in dairying either.
So what was that feeling then yesterday, shutting the gate for the last time, knowing that's it?
It's mixed emotions. I sort of got the stage where I was sort of burnt out with it all anyway, with dairying, and, you know, I turned 60 this year and all that end of last year, and it's kind of all I've ever done. It's sad to see them go, but it's always good to know they've gone off to another farm. But the other side is, look, I needed a break from it.
And that's today's Rural News.
Thanks for that, Jane, and good luck to Rick. We spoke to him quite a lot when he was the Australian Dairy Farmers President. Too, always a big decision to get out of your commodity and get out of farming. Really interesting to hear. Good luck, Rick. Edna's in Bendigo on 1300 977 222. Just quickly before we get the weather report, Edna, you're ringing about the dingo fence. What did you want to say?
Well, if you do anything wrong on the road, the police fine you. And we've got these people in office not doing anything at all. All yap. There's far too much yap. And they're not helping the farmers at all. Do this, do that, do something else. Now, I think it's about time, if you don't represent and serve, you don't deserve to be there. You should be kicked out. Now, why is it going on? It's a people thing. It doesn't matter how you put it, it comes back to the people thing. And you've got no one representing the farmer, not genuinely doing it. There's plenty of yap, but nothing. And I'm just so fed up with all the things that people have got to leave their farms. The next generation doesn't get a chance. What are we doing with Australia?
Edna, I can hear it loud and clear in your voice, and thank you very much for giving us a call and voicing your opinion as well. The phone line's not the best, and I have to get to the Bureau of Meteorology, but thank you very much for your call all the same. Let's go to Daniel Sherwin-Simpson, who is a senior forecaster at the Bureau of Meteorology on this beautiful, warm winter's day. Daniel, how are you?
Yeah, I'm well, thank you, Warwick. It's warm where I am, but some people might not be seeing that at the moment. It's a real mixed bag around the state. The warmest place, surprisingly, is Yarram Airport down in Gippsland right now.
That's about the first time ever. That's the first time ever Yarram has been the warmest place in Victoria.
Ooh, just a quick update. They've just been equaled by Mildura.
Oh, that makes
21.3 as well. So I think Mildura will overtake them as we speak, Warwick, but it did have the highest temperature in the state for about half an hour or so. But I think, yeah, Mildura, we're looking at a top of 23 today. So, look, broadly, quite unusually warm across the state today. Although, as I mentioned, some places aren't too warm at the moment. If you're in Ballarat right now, you're still sitting in some foggy, drizzly, sort of misty conditions, only around 12 degrees or so. So it does probably feel pretty wintry and a bit dreary up there, out through sort of the Maston and Central Ranges. Bit foggy, misty, kind of sad wintry weather as you get sort of more towards Seymour area. That's where things clear up pretty much. If you're out in the east of the state, you're looking at mostly clear skies. And that's all due to a fairly warm and a little bit of a humid northeasterly airstream that's coming down from New South Wales at the moment, ahead of a cold front that's going to sweep over us tomorrow. So we will be on for a fairly warm night with widespread cloud cover and windier conditions overnight, keeping those warmer temperatures near the surface. As we see this front move over, probably expecting most people in the state to receive at least some rainfall. It's going to be one of those nice sort of traditional cold fronts that brings rainfall to most people across the state. If you're up sort of near the Murray, sort of from about Mildura down to Echuca, you might only be looking at 2 to 5 millimetres. Elsewhere, though, 5 to 10. And then as you move across the ranges, you could be seeing something more near 10 to 20, possibly even 20 to 30 up towards the Alpine ranges. If you're in East Gippsland, you'll have to wait maybe till the earlier parts of Sunday morning to get that. But yeah,
but I think East Gippsland's going to get it.
Wet weather.
Yeah.
Yeah, they'll certainly see it come through. They'll just have to wait until the early parts of Sunday morning. So yeah, I think it'll be a struggle to see anyone who doesn't see some rainfall come through with this front.
And just along those lines, personalised weather forecast time, Daniel, we did have a text yesterday from Jack up at Narong, northeast Victoria, just wondering about the forecast for Saturday and early next week, just wondering whether I start putting floaties on my sheep before rain, go the Dons this weekend, time to get James Heard back, says Jack. Jack, that's an interesting take. I hope the rain takes better for you than your controversial Dons opinion. So Narong, sort of, we'd say rather Glen, really, that sort of area of the northeast Victoria. What's he looking at, Daniel?
Yeah, so the northeast tomorrow, you could start seeing a few sort of hit or miss showers popping up from the late morning tomorrow, but that real sort of proper frontal rain band where the heavier stuff will come through, that's going to probably come through in the evening up in that northeast area around Rubber Glen, and then it'll sort of start to ease off as we move into the early parts of Sunday, and then there could be the odd spot lingering Sunday afternoon, but by the time we get to the evening on Sunday, it'll be well and truly gone, and we'll have a high-pressure system sitting over us. So really, once we get into that Sunday-Monday period, things settle out across large parts of the state. We do have another front scheduled sort of over western Victoria. Now, that's sort of umming and ahhing a bit. It's kind of stalling in the bite, so it might sit around South Australia through Tuesday and Wednesday. Could possibly see some showers creeping into western Vic, but at the moment, we're expecting that front to sort of drift over us on Wednesday into Thursday. There's still quite a lot of uncertainty with that system. It's really chopping and changing with every update of our weather models that we get, but you should expect another sort of wet front coming through sometime mid-next week.
So highly likely we will get some moisture, but what the story of that moisture is, that might be the difficulty at the moment with those models, yeah?
Yeah, I think you're exactly right. This one coming through tomorrow is pretty much locked in, but yeah, mid-next week, there's still a little bit of wiggle room in the forecast. You'll likely see with the afternoon update of your forecast today, things will chop and change a little bit for sort of your Tuesday through to Thursday period. So another system will come through, and it will bring a bit of rainfall, but it might not be as widespread as what we're expecting with this system moving through. So yeah, if you're looking out for rainfall, definitely this one coming up tomorrow is the one to look for.
I got a couple of questions for you, so I'll get to those in just a minute. But warnings for today and the weekend, Daniel, are we looking at anything specific there?
Yeah, so we don't have any warnings out right now other than sort of some marine wind warnings for your coastal waters. Just with this front coming over, there is going to be a lot of wind aloft. Because of all the cloud cover, we're probably going to struggle to mix that wind down to the surface. So it'll really be your elevated locations that will see some stronger winds. If you're on the Divide or possibly even down in the Otways, you could be seeing sort of 60 to 80 kilometre an hour gusts starting from this evening, continuing until tomorrow afternoon. Possibility we could see gusts getting up around the 90k mark in the Alpine ranges. It's a really sort of marginal case where we might just be able to get one or two gusts mixed down. So if you're up in those Alpine ranges area, we might issue a warning later this evening if we see those gusts develop. But I think it'll probably be much the same in terms of wind as what we saw from the last front earlier in the week. But we are going to have more rainfall with this front compared to the last one.
And Daniel, clearly I'm sitting in my ivory tower, which is the ABC Shepparton studio, talking to you about warmth and sunshine that I can see out my window. But I've had a text from Ballarat saying, can you ask when the fog's going to clear? Bendigo, still foggy as in Bendigo. Stuart saying, sad and dreary to hear at Clunes today. Pea soup fog still. Daughters working in glorious sunshine at Carrumbalik, says Stuart. So what's going on with the fog? Will it clear for some of those areas of Central Vic?
Yeah, Ballarat's been a bit of an interesting one. Through the morning, we saw the fog develop, then it sort of lifted into low cloud, and now it's come back through the late morning and the afternoon. So that is sort of going up and down a little bit at the moment. We are starting to see that cloud cover fully contract. So Swan Hill had a bit at the moment. That's really cleared out of there. Bendigo's probably going to clear out in the next half an hour, I'd say Ballarat might hold onto it a bit longer. Ballarat could be a bit up and down, so you could get some low cloud that just lifts up above the surface, your visibility comes back, you get a bit of drizzle that comes through it and brings it back down over the next couple of hours. So yeah, Ballarat's going to be a little bit changeable and will probably stay pretty dreary until we get into the later parts of the afternoon.
Oh, it's dreary in Ballarat in winter? Call me surprised. Daniel, call me surprised. You did make me surprised when you said Yarram was the warmest part in Victoria earlier on, though. And I hope you have a good weekend, and we'll catch you again on Monday, or someone from the Bureau on Monday.
Cheers, you too, Warwick.
Daniel Sherwin-Simpson, Senior Forecaster at the Bureau of Meteorology, taking you through the full forecast there. A lot of text coming in. And Edna, I hope you're listening. Edna called from Bendigo. We had to cut it short because we had to get to the Bureau and the phone line wasn't great. But Shovel says, vote one, Edna. Another one saying Edna's 110% spot on. Find politicians who aren't up to scratch or remove them from jobs. That's called an election. That's how we remove politicians who aren't up to scratch from their jobs. But another text, and I've just lost it. There was another person saying they were very happy with the work. Head of Monkey says, go Edna, if you ran for government, I'd vote for you, hands down. That's coming in. So Edna, if you're listening, bit of love there. But a bit more seriously and more widely, on the dingo fence that is now being built across 70 kilometres of the Big Desert, and what that means for neighbours and what that means in terms of the situation as well. These texts have come in saying, hi, Woz, it's crazy that a government would dump such a law on amazing farmers. They have enough to contend with to manage our dogs with their hands tied behind their backs. Jackie at Gifford says, I'm a little confused. I've spoken to dingo experts and Googled AI, and all these sources say dogs actually don't have dog genes, that they're dingoes. Jackie, we did cover that a lot with that research that was being referred to by those farmers out of Adelaide University. I think it said, they were saying 30% today, but I think it's 13% of dingoes was seen to be wild dog genetics, or domestic dogs bought since colonisation genetics. And we've reported on that extensively. You can find that. Don't go to Google AI, I would suggest, but you can go find the original source material from the University of Adelaide, or that debate around that in a story from Angus Verley at abc.net.au/rural. And then this text says, dogs, the old story about rules and regulations. They should ask, do they want to eat or starve? That's the commentary coming in on our text line at the moment. You can always send your thoughts, 0467 842 722. Look, we talked about a definite merger that's happening in the wool industry before news and weather. Well, the 120-year-old member group Jersey Australia say they're considering merging with Holstein Australia to create a united breed association of the two biggest breeds in Australia in dairy. The potential merger comes as Jersey Australia's new president, Gippsland dairy farmer Rob Anderson, said the dairy industry is facing a range of challenges. He told Fiona Broom, our reporter, there are still plenty of opportunities for Jersey producers as the breed grows in popularity not only at home but overseas.
The Jersey breed here in Australia has made great progress, I would say, in the last 10 to 20 years. We've used a lot of genetics from around the world, and there's been some astute breeders that have focused on cow families. Here in Australia, we've got grazing, we've got barns, and we've been able to breed a cow that's got quite a lot of capacity and produces extremely well for what intake she consumes.
Australian Jersey genetics have been going right around the world. Why is there interest in the Jersey cow rather than, you know, say something more high producing like Holstein?
Well, I suppose it comes back to the countries that's looking at us. You know, I know there was a shipment that went to Indonesia this last year. South Africa is a big market for the Jersey population. The Holstein cow does have, you know, greater volume. There's no doubt about that. But I think when you look at the economics of a Jersey cow for what she can produce, kilos of milk solids compared to body weight, she's a very economical and efficient breed of cow and quite adaptable to a lot of situations.
Yeah, so are people looking for a cow that can produce fresh milk, or are they looking for that milk to go into other products?
You know, the industry here in Australia is quite diverse, so it could be going into a cheese company, it could be going into yogurt, it could be going into the liquid milk market, so that's where you'll have a little bit of breed preference. you know, you could say going up the eastern seaboard, they have a little bit more of a breed preference to Holstein because they're in more into the liquid milk market. So milk going into Brisbane or those areas, into your carton milk. Ourselves, we were supplying a cheese company just recently because it suited our production and what we were producing fat and protein out the gate. So it does depend a little bit on that too, who you supply.
What is it about the jersey that you love, Rob?
Well, I've been born and bred with jerseys. So, you know what I mean? That's a big part in history and legacy of my family. We've had the jersey breed's been in our family for over 140 years. But for me, you know, it's the size of the cow, what she can produce. She's very easy to work with. You know, she's a very eager animal that, you know what I mean, grazes extremely well and moves and walks extremely well. So, It's a cow that's easily to work with, and for me and staff as well, that can manage it quite comfortably.
Well, you've gone from heading up breeding and genetics at Jersey Australia to now holding the position of president. What's on your agenda and what's next for the breed?
As far as the year ahead, you know, or this last year, we did a breed publication in joint partnership with Holstein Australia, and there's some other discussions happening with Holstein Australia, which we're not too sure where that will lead us to in the next 12 or 24 months, but we're just trying to better service the members and keep the association strong to push forward for the next 10, 20 years, as long as the members wish to have an association there.
What are the conversations that you're having with Holstein?
Well, it's how we can best help each other at this stage, whether it's a joining of offices, a merger, a new entity, and then having both breeds under that. It's early days at this stage.
And what would that sort of be in aid of for your members?
Well, it's just any registered database virtually does the same processing, whether it's Holstein, Jersey, Ayrshires, Brown Swiss, let's say. So, you know, I mean, there's a lot of synergies between having potentially one association that does that processing. A lot of the dairy breeds, we sort of do our own little separate thing, but, you know, we could probably come under one umbrella and just rebadge it for each particular breed under that. So it's just something we've just got to look forward. The dairy herd is shrinking, so then that actually puts more pressure on an administrative point of view. So you've got to look at what your core costs are, and administration is a key cost to any organisation. And how do we negate out of that to make sure that we're still profitable at the other end?
So looking at this a bit more as a dairy sort of issue rather than an individually breed-specific sort of issue?
Well, it's going to affect every breed at some point in time. It's and maybe the minor breeds are already there, but we've just got to be a little bit proactive and make a hard decision before it's too late, I suppose.
That's Gippsland dairy farmer Rob Anderson, new president of the Breed Association Jersey Australia. Let's finish today with the students at St Paul's in Walla Walla, north of Albury, who have cattle, sheep, chickens, and even a vineyard on their 80-hectare working farm. Annie Brown went along, met a few students in the agriculture program, and talked to them about their plans.
My name's Remy Barter. I'm from the Kayla Valley, so Toowoonga South, and I'm in year 11 currently.
I'm Martha McGrath. I'm a year 11 boarder from Tumbarumba.
Well, Remy, I might start with you. Tell me a bit about all the different types of agriculture and primary industries that you guys learn about here at St Paul's, because we're in the middle of one of the yards at the moment, and there's lots of different things that you guys do here.
There is lots. We have chickens, merinos, we've got like Suffolks, we've got lots of cows. Pretty much we've got a lot of things going on. We've got even got a new vineyard. Yeah, sorry about the sheep yards are a bit wet, but yeah.
Is agriculture something that everybody at the school gets really involved in?
Most kids do. There's the occasional few that like would don't do it. They do like art or drama or something. But I'd say most of the kids here, they love their ag and get right into it.
Yeah. It's like it's essentially like a working farm here, isn't it?
Yeah, 100%. Yeah.
And Martha, tell us a bit about what are some of the things that you enjoy learning about here in terms of agriculture?
I've loved being part of the show team. They've been really supportive. They've taught me so much about sheep that I would have never learnt just on a farm. I've learnt so much about muscle definition, shearing. And another thing was the equine centre. I've learnt a lot about riding horses and I've really improved as a rider. And of course, I've had my horse here, I can adjust, and I've just loved to be with it and around it. And the teachers are just amazing. They really improve all our knowledge all across the agriculture industry.
So you're from Tumbarumba, so you're bored here and you get to have your horse here as well. It's amazing.
Yeah, I've really loved it because I've missed riding at home during the week. And of course, Tumba's in the middle of nowhere, so it's really nice to feel close to home, just have a part of home at school.
That's lovely, yeah. And tell us a bit about, I guess, home. So big into horse riding?
Yes, we run a small beef farm at home and we are on a giant hill. So we don't use machinery to round up cattle. We use horses. And everyone in my family rides. We all just get right into it.
And is farming, agriculture, something you're looking at pursuing after school or something a bit different?
Definitely. I'm interested in a dual degree in law and agriculture because farmers need lawyers. We all need that.
Remy, I don't know if I asked you about this, sorry, but tell us a bit about, I know you want to be a veterinarian after school. Is that something you want to pursue?
I'd love to be a vet. I'd love to go to Charles Sturt in Wagga. I'd love to go there and do vet after school. I think it'd be a really rewarding career. Yeah, I've done work experience at a couple of vets and I love it. It's so much. It's good.
Yeah, my name's Sophie Howard. I'm in year 9 here at St. Paul's. At school, I'm on the show team and I do ag and farm studies, get involved with the show team. I'm from Culcairn, which is about 20 minutes away from Walla. Just catch a bus to school every morning.
Do you come from a farming family, farming background?
Not really. We have like a little block, but it's sort of not really. Just live in town, sort of, yeah.
Yeah, I'm Sam Wayne. I'm a boarder in year 10 here at St. Paul's. And yeah, I do ag, show team and farm studies.
Where's home for you, Sam?
About 60 k's west of Wagga, on a farm out there, yeah.
Well, Sophie, I'll start with you. Tell us a bit about, I guess, your involvement with the cattle show team.
Yeah, so since year 7, I've done show team, like the cattle show team with the school, just going to shows near and far from Wagga, and yeah, it's been a good experience. I learned a lot.
So what's one of the recent shows you've been to, or what are you working towards?
There's not many cattle shows on at the moment, but a couple of weeks ago or last week I went to Holbrook Sheep Show, actually. One of the most recent shows would be Henty Show last term. And one of the biggest shows I want to go to is Scone, which is in term 3. It's about 8 hours away, so, yeah.
And tell us a bit about your cows, like what kind of cows, how are they going?
Yeah, well, we have quite a few Angus cows at the moment, or Limousins from Kajira Park at Tumut, and we have a Rennie Lee heifer or steer at the moment, so yeah, and a couple of shorthorns, I think.
Did you do any cattle showing or livestock showing before you came to school here at St. Paul's?
No, I actually didn't. One of my friends has been involved with cattle showing for ages, and she like told me that I should give it a go, and I did, and now I love it, so... I love the people you meet and the things you learn and the places you get to go that I wouldn't go to if I didn't do show team.
And Sam, tell us a bit about the sheep showing team you've got here at St. Paul's.
Yeah, so we've got a white Suffolk stud, which we've had for a couple of years now, quite a few, and recently just started a Merino stud as well. So, yeah, we show them in shows such as Canberra last term, Holbrook, Henty, Gamain, Wagga.
Lots of places, yeah. And how does St. Paul's do in the sheep side of things?
Yeah, we've had some very good runs at recent local shows as well. We had a pretty good run at Canberra the last 2 years as well. Nice. Won plenty of ribbons up there, yeah.
And what's it like when you get to the shows? Like, what's it like from your perspective?
Yeah, you'd probably find it more casual than the cattle show. But yeah, it's a lot of fun. You meet a lot of people, getting a lot of new experiences.
And did you pick sheep over cattle? Like, do you get a preference or is it kind of...
You get a choice. I had more experience with sheep than I did cattle when I came to here, so I just went that way.
Did you come from a farming background?
Yeah, I come from a farm, yeah, mainly sheep farm.
And what is it about it that you enjoy? And is it something you want to pursue as well or keep going?
Yeah, I just like being outdoors, having a good time with people, showing sheep. Yeah, being out of the classroom, always a good way to learn.
A group of legends from St. Paul's in Walla Walla taking you into your weekend here on the Country Hour. We'll be back with you on